but also as proof that the vision itself is misguided, naive. That there are too many people in this town who actually benefit from partisanship and gridlock for us to ever do anything about it. I know how tempting such cynicism may be, but I still think the cynics are wrong. I still believe that we are one people. I still believe that together we can do great things, even when the odds are long. I believe this because over and over in my 6 years in office, I have seen America at its best. I've seen the hopeful faces of young graduates from New York to California, and our newest officers at West Point, Annapolis, Colorado Springs, New London. I've mourned with grieving families in Tucson and Newtown, in Boston, in West Texas, in West Virginia. I've watched Americans beat back adversity from the Gulf Coast to the Great Plains, from Midwest assembly lines to the Mid-Atlantic seaboard. I've seen something like gay marriage go from a wedge issue used to drive us apart to a story of freedom across our country, a civil right now legal in states that 7 in 10 Americans call home. So I know the good and optimistic and big-hearted generosity of the American people who every day live the idea that we are our brother's keeper and our sister's keeper. And I know they expect those of us who serve here to set a better example. So the question for those of us here tonight is how we, all of us, can better reflect America's hopes. I've served in Congress with many of you. I know many of you well. There are a lot of good people here on both sides of the aisle. And many of you have told me that this isn't what you signed up for. Arguing past each other on cable shows, the constant fundraising, always looking over your shoulder at how the base will react to every decision. Imagine if we broke out of these tired old patterns. Imagine if we did something different. Understand, a better politics isn't one where Democrats abandon their agenda or Republicans simply embrace mine. A better politics is one where we appeal to each other's basic decency instead of our basest fears. A better politics is one where we debate without demonizing each other. Where we talk issues and values and principles and facts rather than gotcha moments or trivial gaffes or fake controversies that have nothing to do with people's daily lives. A better politics is one where we spend less time drowning in dark money for ads that pull us into the gutter, and spend more time lifting young people up with a sense of purpose and possibility, asking them to join in the great mission of building America. If we're going to have arguments, let's have arguments, but let's make them debates worthy of this body and worthy of this country. We still may not agree on a woman's right to choose, but surely we can agree it's a good thing that teen pregnancies and abortions are nearing all-time lows and that every woman should have access to the health care that she needs. Yes, passions still fly on immigration, but surely we can all see something of ourselves in the striving young student and agree that no one benefits when a hardworking mom is snatched from her child, and then it's possible to shape a law that upholds our tradition as a nation of laws and a nation of immigrants. I've talked to Republicans and Democrats about that. That's something that we can share. We may go at it in campaign season, but surely we can agree that the right to vote is sacred, that it's being denied to too many, and that on this 50th anniversary of the Great March from Selma to Montgomery and the passage of the Voting Rights Act, we can come together, Democrats and Republicans, to make voting easier for every single American. We may have different takes on the events of Ferguson and New York, but surely we can understand a father who fears his son can't walk home without being harassed. And surely we can understand the wife who won't rest until the police officer she married walks through the front door at the end of his shift. And surely we can agree that it's a good thing that for the first time in 40 years, the crime rate and the incarceration rate have come down together. And use that as a starting point for Democrats and Republicans, community leaders and law enforcement, to reform America's criminal justice system so that it protects and serves all of us. That's a better politics. That's how we start rebuilding trust. That's how we move this country forward. That's what the American people want. And that's what they deserve. I have no more campaigns to run. My only agenda, I know because I won both of them. My only agenda for the next 2 years is the same as the one I've had since the day I swore an oath on the steps of this Capitol: to do what I believe is best for America. If you share the broad vision I outlined tonight, I ask you to join me in the work at hand. If you disagree with parts of it, I hope you'll at least work with me where you do agree. And I commit to every Republican here tonight that I will not only seek out your ideas, I will seek to work with you to make this country stronger. Because I want this chamber, I want this city, to reflect the truth that for all our blind spots and shortcomings, we are a people with the strength and generosity of spirit to bridge divides, to unite in common effort, to help our neighbors, whether down the street or on the other side of the world. I want our actions to tell every child in every neighborhood, your life matters. And we are committed to improving your life chances, as committed as we are to working on behalf of our own kids. I want future generations to know that we are a people who see our differences as a great gift. That we're a people who value the dignity and worth of every citizen. Man and woman, young and old, black and white, Latino, Asian, immigrant, Native American, gay, straight, Americans with mental illness or physical disability. Everybody matters. I want them to grow up in a country that shows the world what we still know to be true. That we are still more than a collection of red states and blue states. That we are the United States of America. I want them to grow up in a country where a young mom can sit down and write a letter to her president with a story that sums up these past 6 years. It's amazing what you can bounce back from when you have to. We are a strong, tight-knit family who's made it through some very, very hard times. My fellow Americans, we too are a strong, tight-knit family. We too have made it through some hard times. 15 years into this new century, we have picked ourselves up, dusted ourselves off, and begun again the work of remaking America. We have laid a new foundation. A brighter future is ours to write. Let's begin this new chapter together. And let's start the work right now. Thank you. God bless you. God bless this country we love. Thank you.
Welcoming you back into Voice of America's special coverage of the 2015 State of the Union. Good evening. I'm Cal Perry, joined by Jim Malone. Hello again to our audiences around the world, watching on TV, listening on the radio, or checking us out on the web. That was U.S. President Barack Obama's sixth State of the Union, his second to last State of the Union. He will now make his way out of the chamber and eventually back to the White House, where we find our own Luis Ramirez. Luis, the speech, certainly right off the bat, a lot there for the base to get excited about.
Clearly a victory speech, Cal. The president saying we've turned a page, the shadow of crisis has passed, says the State of the Union is good. As we expected, big focus on the economy, the improving numbers, the general situation that is getting better, lower gas prices making Americans happier than they were certainly just a year ago. Two things that struck me here, Cal, were one, this address was much more conciliatory than we had expected. We expected the president with 2 years left in office, as he said, more campaigns to run. He was largely expected to be confrontational, to say, well, I'm going to ram these my proposals, my agenda through, like it or not. And instead, what we heard is talk of us being a united family. He called on Republicans to work with him on areas where they do agree. That's going to be a tough one. President acknowledging that while the Republicans may see eye to eye on the needs for improving the lives of Americans, paying for them is a matter where they most certainly will disagree. And I think that's where we can continue to see the more friction in the couple of years ahead.
I want to check in with Ann Ball, who's back in her perch overlooking the Capitol. I thought the president's attitude, his demeanor, very interesting. There was that moment there where he said, I have no more campaigns to run. We heard kind of a sarcastic reply there from Republicans in the chamber, and he then kind of quickly jumped in and said, I know that because I've won my last two. Clearly, this is a president who in many ways feels unencumbered, a second-term president. Ann, what was your take?
Oh, I agree with that. I think we're seeing a change in him. And I think part of that is his poll numbers have gone up from December to January. They went up 9 points in the Washington Post ABC poll. And I think we're seeing a renewed energy in the president. Partly that is from his ability to do these things like immigration, take these actions and measures that don't need congressional approval. And maybe he's energized by that. Something is getting done in Washington. Unfortunately, it's not between the White House and the Congress, but he's taking action. And that combined with the lower gas prices, I think, are making Americans feel like things might be moving a little bit.
Crossing back to Luis Ramirez, we're going to lose Luis at some point there at his perch on Pebble Beach, so I want to get some thoughts here. We are looking forward to the Republican response by Joni Ernst. Luis, you sort of laid out for us a very conciliatory tone when it comes to a lot of these issues that he wants to push through. What do you expect to hear from the Republican response? Do you expect that to be conciliatory too?
That's very hard to gauge at this point. My guess would be that it will not be. Certainly the areas of disagreement are so wide. This issue of President Obama's push to raise capital gains tax, extremely unpopular, very unlikely to make any progress in Congress. Another point where there is likely to be continue to be friction is on the in the area of national security. One of the things that struck me was how little the president talked about the issue of terrorism, something that's been on very much on the minds of many Americans in the wake of attacks in Paris, also in the wake of attacks in Pakistan, but more so Paris. Very little mention, just barely in passing, a mention of that. There is also a great deal of dissatisfaction among Republicans about the pace of progress against the Islamic State, the way that whole fight has been carried out. We can certainly expect to see no conciliatory remarks in regard to that. But I think at this point, with the agenda focused on domestic issues, capital gains tax, a big, big, big stumbling block.
Yeah, Ann, I want to get Ann Ball to sort of weigh in on this international side of things. Two things that stuck out to me. While he didn't, as Louise says, he didn't really address the Islamic State directly, he did say it's, quote, important that we continue to reject offensive stereotypes of Muslims. That's something I think right now, especially in this country and in Europe, everybody is paying close attention to. And then on Guantanamo Bay, now it's time to finish the job, he said. I will not relent in my determination to shut us down. It's not who we are. And my question to you really is, this obviously comes on the heels of the CIA torture report, but this seems like an issue that people are going to be able to come together on, yes?
Well, yes, and I think there was some applause. Well, certainly applause about going after the Islamic State. And I think that's pretty clear. There will be money there. He said that we need to go after them. And that's something that they're going to have to work together on. And it might come in the form of money. I mean, certainly there's no appetite for putting U.S. troops on the ground. There are boots on the ground as advisors training fighters to go in to fight the Islamic State. But, you know, more in the form of drones and, you know, things that they can do without actually committing U.S. troops. But again, these are the issues that they might be able to work together on. I think the things that they obviously will not work together on are the tax issues. And we're going to hear from Senator Joni Ernst. And she's going to talk about the Republican ideas of how to help the middle class. And those two, the Democrats and the Republicans are far apart. I saw that some of the Republican senators didn't look too happy when they cut to pictures of their reactions to the president talking about the need for tax reform.
Yeah, and certainly there's going to be a number of issues. And as we bring it into the studio, let me turn to you, Elizabeth, and sort of ask you, what were some of the other issues that you saw where we know there's going to be a split?
So I think, you know, the president touched on some sort of core issues that are, you know, for the Democratic base. So he mentioned equal pay. He mentioned, you know, child care. He mentioned minimum wage. He mentioned, you know, gay marriage. And I think those are all potential areas where we're not going to see the Republicans on the same page.
You know, we're just watching President Obama. He's taking his time leaving the chamber. This is a more relaxed, in some ways conciliatory, as Luis said, but I would argue also defiant. He's, at this point, he's showing how he deals with political adversity in my view. And he was also, and my colleague over here, Matt, mentioned it, this idea of channeling back to where he started, the candidate Obama, trying to bring that full circle now. It's kind of like he's a bit wrapped up in his own narrative of political life, but he wants to try to return the country to that. I think he was not appealing, though, to the members of Congress in the chamber, but to the American public. He sees his poll ratings going up, and I think now he's making a bid to try to solidify that public support. That will help them in the congressional battles to come. That means a lot.
And harken back to that, he said just over a decade ago, he gave a speech in Boston where I said there wasn't a liberal America, a conservative America, a black America, or a white America. So he's clearly harkening back to those speeches.
Republicans won a big victory a few months ago. If they thought he was going to fold up his tent, turn over, cower and look away, they're sorely mistaken. And I think he's sending that message out loud and clear. He can veto much of what they want to do. The question is, are we just going to set up for 2 years passing bills and having them stopped, or will there be genuine efforts to work together? The jury's still out on that, the way I see it.
No, absolutely. I mean, the set-piece speech is one of Barack Obama's greatest strengths, and we've seen that throughout his entire political career. He talks a great optimistic game. He speaks to some core aspirational values that are in American culture and society. But he's governed from a very cynical, pragmatic political place. We saw that when they passed the health care law on Christmas Eve and throughout his entire administration. Only 30% of his State of the Union promises have actually been kept. So, you know, this speech was, I think, a little more conciliatory than a lot of folks were expecting. But he's talked a great game in the past, and when the rubber meets the road, it's going to be very interesting to see how this pans out.
I believe he is now signing the tie of a Senate page on his way out of the chamber, and now we will stand by and wait for the Republican response from Joni Ernst. I thought it was interesting when we were chatting sort of during the speech, we were talking about how the Republicans should play this. You know, are they better off coming out conciliatory? And you said something fascinating. You said, you know, they could come out with some of these but alternatives to these.
And I think you are going to see, you know, the ideas generated more and more. You know, one of the things when you have both the House and the Senate is it's not enough to just say no. You need to be able to come out and you know, put some platform forward. And you don't have the same leadership position that you do, you know, when you have the executive office. But I think you are going to see Republican Senate and House leadership work together to put some conservative solutions on the president's desk and sort of turn this back on him, make him pull out the veto pen and be the one who's saying no.
What we're about to see is one of the toughest acts in Washington. You have to follow an experienced commander-in-chief. The public knows him well. This will be Joni Ernst's debut on the national stage. It's a tough spot.
And the president's almost hit his stride.
No crowd there to cheer her on. So it's not an easy place to be.
We still have Luis Ramirez from the White House, and I want to try to take as much advantage of that as we can. Luis, there is, when we talk about the veto pen, when we talk about some of these issues, Iran is front and center. And he made it clear today that he believes sanctions could derail the talks.
Well, he made it very clear he will veto any attempt to slap new sanctions or to tighten existing sanctions on Iran. He has called such an action would be counterproductive at this time when negotiations are underway that have probably brought Iran the closest it has been to a deal with the international community possess nuclear weapons. President Obama had the support of British Prime Minister David Cameron here at the White House last Friday, also saying that sanctions at this time are not a good idea. Now, the president has said that sanctions may be the way to go if no deal is reached, but at this point, bad idea.
He also flagged, Luis, the issue of cyber terrorism, certainly something that has been front page news here in the United States.
This has been a very big issue. You can recall with the film The Interview, where the FBI determined that North Korea was behind the hacking of Sony Pictures. That certainly brought the issue home to many Americans. But since then, you know, a great deal of discussion has been going on in the building behind me about tightening cybersecurity. An issue that the president has been in discussion with foreign leaders, notably, again, Prime Minister Cameron. The two countries have been in dialogue on the rules behind the monitoring of social media to weed out terrorism, to intercept any terrorist operations. So that was, as expected, a prominent part of this address.
Were you surprised, Luis, that there was a section on climate change? I mean, this is certainly not something that's going to reach across the aisle.
I was not at all surprised, Cal, because essentially the president in the speech we just heard said this is something to the effect that this is the biggest threat to future generations. What he believes is a threat that not only this country but obviously the world faces. One of his big accomplishments in the year that passed was a landmark climate deal with China. Very few people thought such a thing possible. He pulled it off. He knows that he is not going to get support from across the aisle, as you said, but it's nonetheless important enough to him to bring it out, to take the message to the American people, which is exactly what he did here.
Elizabeth, he opened the speech with the story of Rebecca and Ben Earler. I mean, this is sort of politics 101, right? The story of an American middle-class couple going through economic struggles.
Absolutely. And, you know, it really, it's the type of story that really touches that independence, which will help him sort of, you know, garner that public support that Jim was talking about that he'll need to go with Congress. And it's a story that everybody relates to, you know, and as Democrats and Republicans move forward here, they're going to have to be able to relate to voters and show that they understand their needs and the challenges that they're still going through. And so this story really personifies, you know, those challenges, and he laid out a plan how hard work and some of these additional policies are able to help them.
Sorry, we are now standing by for the Republican response, and I believe it is here.
Good evening. I'm Joni Ernst. As a mother, a soldier, and a newly elected senator from the great state of Iowa, I am proud to speak with you tonight. A few moments ago, we heard the president lay out his vision for the year to come. Even if we may not always agree, it's important to hear different points of view in this great country. We appreciate the president sharing his. Tonight, though, rather than respond to a speech, I'd like to talk about your priorities. I'd like to have a conversation about the new Republican Congress you just elected and how we plan to make Washington focus on your concerns again. We heard the message you sent in November, loud and clear, and now we're getting to work to change the direction Washington has been taking our country. The new Republican Congress also understands how difficult these past 6 years have been. For many of us, the sting of the economy and the frustration with Washington's dysfunction weren't things we had to read about. We felt them every day. We felt them in Red Oak, the little town in southwestern Iowa where I grew up and am still proud to call home today. As a young girl, I plowed the fields of our family farm. I worked construction with my dad. To save for college, I worked the morning biscuit line at Hardee's. We were raised to live simply, not to waste. It was a lesson my mother taught me every rainy morning. You see, growing up, I had only one good pair of shoes. So on rainy school days, my mom would slip plastic bread bags over them to keep them dry. But I was never embarrassed, because the school bus would be filled with rows and rows of young Iowans with bread bags slipped over their feet. Our parents may not have had much, but they worked hard for what they did have. These days, though, many families feel like they're working harder and harder with less and less to show for it, not just in Red Oak, but across the country. We see our neighbors agonize over stagnant wages and lost jobs. We see the hurt caused by canceled health care plans and higher monthly insurance bills. We see too many moms and dads put their own dreams on hold while growing more fearful about the kind of future they'll be able to leave to their children. Americans have been hurting, but when we demanded solutions too often, Washington responded with the same stale mindset that led to failed policies like Obamacare. It's a mindset that gave us political talking points, not serious solutions. That's why the new Republican majority you elected started by reforming Congress to make it function again. And now we're working hard to pass the kind of serious job creation ideas you deserve. One you've probably heard about is the Keystone Jobs Bill. President Obama has been delaying this bipartisan infrastructure project for years, even though many members of his party, unions, and a strong majority of Americans support it. The president's own State Department has said Keystone's construction could support